Hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked and I believe them, for I've seen your painted women under the gas lamps luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked and I answer yes, it is true, I have seen the gunmen kill and go free to kill again. And they tell me you are brutal, and my reply is, on the faces of women and children, I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. And having answered so, I turn once more to those who sneer at this my city, and I give them back the sneer and say to them, come and show me another city with lifted heads, singing so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning, flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job. Here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little soft cities. Fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness, bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding, under the smoke, dust all over his mouth, laughing with white teeth, under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle, bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse and under his ribs the heart of the people, laughing. Laughing, the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth, half-naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, toolmaker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and freight handler to the nation. Welcome to the Chicago Hamburg 30 podcast series sponsored by the Amerikazentrum Hamburg. I'm your host, Douglas Cowie. I'm a writer and teacher. In each episode of this series, my guests and I will discuss a work of literature set primarily in Chicago. Episode, we'll be discussing Chicago Poems by Carl Sandburg, which was first published in 1916. My guest today is Michael Coyle. Professor of English at Colgate University, Michael Coyle is founding president of the Modernist Studies Association, past president of the International T.S. Eliot Society, and has served on the advisory boards of the National Poetry Foundation and the Raymond Williams Society. He writes about modernist poets like T.S. Eliot, Mina Loy, Langston Hughes, and Ezra Pound, as well as definitively modernist cultural developments like jazz radio and, of course, the martini cocktail. And Coyle's A Fool for Beauty, Modernism, and the Racial Semiotics of Crooning will appear next year in the Cambridge University Press collection, Jazz and American Culture. I'm quite excited to hear about crooning. Thank you for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Total pleasure. I suppose we need to start by just saying who is Carl Sandburg. He's one of these curious figures who, when he was alive, everybody read him and everybody knew who he was, and he was famous for a lot of different things. And now, you know, more than 100 years after this first collection of poetry, which we're going to discuss today, his name is everywhere in America. It's on schools. There's a national museum or whatever it is at his house in North Carolina, where he lived towards the end of his life. Libraries are named after him and so on, but he's not someone that people read in universities or schools necessarily anymore. He's known as a biographer of Abraham Lincoln, a poet, a journalist, a collector of folk songs. These are all things that he did. And again, like, he won Pulitzer Prizes. And at the end of his life was a highly regarded American poet.
Well, you know, what happens with American poetry in the 20th century is really interesting, because there's this kind of split, right? On the one side, the modernist poets, all those poets that I usually spend my time thinking about, Pound, Eliot, Mina Loy, Marianne Moore, they're pushing poetry to new levels of intensity and difficulty, self-consciously mm-hmm. difficult. But on the other hand, following Whitman, there's this kind of nativist tradition that possibly found its greatest expression in the work of Langston Hughes or William Carlos Williams. But Sandburg was part of that. And, you know, it's not just that he was a popular poet, right? He was a populist poet. You know, populism, that ideology that's been so important to American history, which presents the people as this force of moral good and always contrasting them favorably against the elites who, you know, in this kind of work tends to show up as corrupt and self-serving. Sandburg was very much part of that.
But yeah.
if you can let me go on for just a moment longer.
Of course.
Doug, I've been thinking about this for a very long time, and I've never really known how to get at it. But I think, you know, looking back between, say, like 1880 and 1920, that's the high watermark of literary culture, right? There were more books sold and read then than at any time before or since. That's the moment when literary culture has its most immediate effect on what we think of as popular culture. People were reading. Movies weren't yet a thing. There was no internet. Radio wasn't a thing. Novels were the ways that you communicated cultural values. And poetry benefited from this too. So this was so much the case that the modernist poets could insult their audiences and sort of dare them to follow, right? The way that Pound and Eliot did.
Insult your audience and be thanked for doing so.
yeah. But expect that people would still continue reading. No poet would do that today because nobody would care.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, and this is where Chicago was so important, as you know, this is your podcast, but these Chicago poets like Vachel Lindsay, Edgar Lee Masters, Harriet Monroe, or Carl Sandburg turned the opposite way, right? They were writing for the people and deeply suspicious of the kind of cultural elitism that literary and cultural modernism represented. So in that context, Sandburg's a really interesting character.
Yeah. I mean, that dynamic of, you know, contempt for the elite and singing the praises of the common man. I always, whenever I say something like that, I think of Barton Fink, the Coen brothers film, where he's always going on about trying to convey the common man. And it makes me feel a bit sheepish. But there's hardly a poem in this collection that doesn't set that dynamic up one way or another. There are some that don't, but like so many of the poems, whenever you see a rich guy at the beginning of a poem in this collection, you know that there's going to be a turn at the end that is about some, you know, working stiff who's got more, you know, he's got some sort of halo around him or something.
Yeah. You know, like another famous example that we could recall is the American poet Edwin Arlington Robinson, who mm-hmm. was writing in the same era. He wasn't from Chicago, but he's the one who wrote Richard Cory, the rich guy who seemed to have everything going for him, owned everything in town, women threw themselves at him. Da 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 da, and then at the end of the poem, he kills himself. Simon and Garfunkel made a song out of that poem.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of populism, and that's central to what Sandburg did.
Well, and it's also, I think, partly through, not just through Sandburg, but I think partly, and maybe, you know, I'm not an expert in this exactly, but like I think for a great deal due to Sandburg, this kind of sets a tone for Chicago literature, I think. Again, this is 1916. Chicago isn't that old of a city at this point. There isn't a lot of nationally known literature set in or about Chicago at this point. You know, basically Sister Carrie, which is 1900 by Theodore Dreiser, which we've covered elsewhere in this series, is kind of it.
Well, there's Upton Sinclair.
Well, yeah, but that's a bit later, isn't it?
It is a bit later. You're right.
But like, there's not a lot, and you know, also Upton Sinclair, well, isn't exactly singing the praises of the city.
Nope. but he's populist though.
Yeah, for sure. And but I think what Sandburg does is marries that populism with a kind of which is prevalent in the civic life of Chicago at this time, with the kind of city boosterism, that, like, you know, all the rich people that he disdains in these poems are also part of this push to, like, be boosters of Chicago and get Chicago on the map and create, you know, this, you know, Paris on Lake Michigan as they wanted to see it, or this rival for New York, as is probably a slightly more realistic view of the city. And Sandberg has that, and it's that kind of populism and critique of the grubby side of the city married to a real love of the city is something that you see again and again in lots of Chicago literature through the middle of the 20th century and later. And I kind of think it, if it doesn't originate with Sandberg, he's certainly the guy that gives it this popular, not just populist, but popular push that makes it a kind of legitimate attitude for serious literature, I think. I don't know if that well, description makes sense.
There are historical reasons for this too, right? Because mm-hmm. the Great Chicago Fire was 1871. So in 1900, Chicago was practically a new city. The whole central part of the downtown had been burned.
Mm-hmm.
One of the great conflagrations.
And the World's Fair had come through in 93.
Yeah. Right. And that also was celebrating Chicago no longer as a frontier town, right? But as you were saying, a rival to New York. So Sandberg was perfect for that. But I am struck by it. And again, it's good that we're talking both about popular and populist. And maybe they were popular because they were populist.
Mm-hmm.
But like Vajil Lindsay thought, well, he defined his work as higher vaudeville.
Yeah,
right?
That's an amazing phrase,
isn't it? To create a poetry that can speak to ordinary people, or Edgar Lee Masters' Spoon River Anthology. Each poem is basically the epitaph on a headstone. Death is the great leveler. So there's his version of populism, and you know, Harriet Monroe, who had been a struggling poet until the New York World published her Columbian Ode, right? Her Ode to the Great Columbian Exhibition without her consent. She won $5,000 in a legal settlement. That was big money in that era.
I love it. And I was going to say that was a lot of money in those days. It's a lot of money in these days for a poem.
For a poet, it is, right? But so when she got that settlement, she took it and founded Poetry Magazine, which to this day remains the single most important journal devoted solely to poetry in English. So Chicago had a big role to play.
And gave Lindsay his start as well, didn't it? Wasn't it the first place to publish Vajil Lindsay?
Yeah, golly, that magazine gave any number of poets their first start. And she may not have been the first to publish Pound or Eliot, but she was among the first. She might have been the first to publish Eliot on reflection. She took The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock after it had been turned down by every single publisher in London. So Chicago wins.
Every time. Turning to Sandberg, something that you and I talked about briefly before is outside of the realms of this podcast is what Archibald MacLeish said about him. I guess after he died, as kind of a, I don't know if I want to call it a eulogy exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It was he gave this talk, maybe 3 or 4 months after Sandberg's death. And essentially what he said was, we remember Sandberg not for any particular poem, but for his entire collective work. Like, as a statement, his entire published work represents one kind of statement, a great championing of the voice of the American people. In other words, MacLeish wasn't going to pretend that Sandberg was the same kind of poet that he himself was, right? Sandberg had sort of scoffed at the free verse experiments of the modernist. You know, he famously said, "Oh, if it gels in the free verse, all right. If it gels in the rhyme, all right." In other words, he presented himself as somebody who didn't worry over much about aesthetic principles. He was just going to tell the truth. He was like a country song, three chords and the truth, right?
That's also kind of BS, though, right? It's like, I mean, that kind of thing is always a pose in an artist, but. But I mean, he even has a poem in this collection called Style. in which he basically contradicts that statement. Style, go ahead talking about style. You can tell where a man gets his style just as you can tell where Pavlova got her legs or Ty Cobb his batting eye. Go on talking, only don't take my style away. It's my face. Maybe no good, but anyway, my face. I talk with it, I sing with it, I see, taste, and feel with it. I know why I want to keep it. Kill my style, and you break Pavlova's legs, and you blind Ty Cobb's batting eye. So, like, this is, you know, he's, it's not like, oh, if it goes this way, fine. If it goes, he's self-consciously creating a style, and he's saying as much in this poem, even while he's still trying to kind of belie it by the things he compares it to, right? Like, oh, I'm the dancer's legs, I'm the baseball player's, you know, hand-eye coordination, whatever. He's still trying to, it's still there, that populist move.
Yeah.
Even though he's self-consciously concerning himself with the style that he writes. And maybe that's as good a fulcrum as any to turn and talk about his style a bit more. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, let's do that. You put your finger on that poem. So here he is, the great man of the people, talking about Pavlova's legs. All right, he wants us to know that he's a real man and he admires a gorgeous woman, right? But so there he's talking about ballet, or in another poem, he praises the Czech violinist and composer Jan Kubelik, right? There's another poem that's a pæan of praise to William Morris. Or in another, actually, there's another poem where he talks about Omar Khayyam's Rubaiyat. But that's less about a high culture than the others, because the Rubaiyat was, and it always has been, immensely popular with readers of poetry. But the fact of the matter is, he'll go from a poem that praises a guy who works with a shovel all day long to a poem that talks about Pavlova. He, I think in his vision, it was all part of the same mosaic, right?
Yeah.
Art in its most accomplished expressions should be part, he thought, of working people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure.
But I'm sorry, you wanted to turn to his style.
Well, his style, yeah. And think a bit about where it comes from and where it leads to, maybe.
Well, you know, I remember what Mencken said of Sandburg, that it was Sandburg who first put America on paper. Kind of a diss to Walt Whitman, but okay.
Yeah.
But I was thinking of that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I was going to say, it's hard to ignore Walt Whitman. Like, it's hard to read Sandburg's poems and not think of Walt Whitman.
Mm-hmm. But what we were talking about the other day is, and I hadn't read Carl Sandburg in a long time, Doug, so thanks for this. But as I was reading him, it hit me, oh, wait a minute. Ginsberg and the Beats, they didn't come directly from Whitman. They came straight through Sandburg. Sandburg is this great, important, mediating voice. And Ginsberg might have thought of himself as a man of the people, but he wasn't a populist. You know, he was too weird in any number of ways to achieve the kind of popularity that Sandburg did. But he took so much from Sandburg's example, including these textures that don't really feel poetic at all. There's this old claim about Sandburg that really the only thing that makes his poems are the irregular left margins. You know, that it's prose presented on a page differently, that his work gives the illusion of poetry. That's not always true, but it's often true. But we could say, and you don't have to agree with me on this, but you know, a prose poem, maybe we can get at something else.
Yeah, so I don't think I do agree with you on that. I think I.
Well,
I think
blame it on Mencken.
Yeah, sure. Mencken, you bastard.
Mencken, the great snob.
Yeah, well, because so the first thing is that, you know, the line, that long line, which Ginsberg uses in Howl in particular, but not just in Howl, and which Sandburg uses often, but not always, really does come from Whitman.
Of course.
And it isn't, you know, it isn't prose. You know, I feel like a prose poem. I mean, there's two of the poems that I like the most in this collection, Chicago, which we'll look at maybe a bit more closely in a bit, and Skyscraper, which is the last one in the original volume Chicago poems, both use this long line, and they're really not prose. They just, you know, a long line doesn't just automatically equate to prose. I think a prose poem has to be a more, I guess, a denser thing, or a slightly less self-consciously controlling line breaks. And even a long line still has a line break. You might argue that the penultimate poem in the collection, To a Contemporary Bunk Shooter, is pretty close to just being, it's just kind of a rant.
Yeah, but it does seem to me that Sandberg was sort of lyrical in imagination, but not in the line. Like, there are very few lines in his poems, at least for me, that resonate. And I'll be delighted, you know, for your pushback if you disagree. You know, he's this populist poet, but back at the time that he published this first of his books, he was greeted as a fellow traveler by the Imagists, who had, you know, launched their revolution in London. It was originally Pound's thing, but it was taken over by the American poet Amy Lowell, who wasn't at all interested in what Pound thought Imagism should be. She was interested in something much more populist, right? So Sandberg fit right in. And I think he benefited from that. But, you know, we want to talk about his style. You've suggested one thing to do, to look at the title poem.
Yeah.
But at some point, I'd like to compare his 1916 poem, Subway,
to Ezra Pound's poem of 1913. Yeah, I was going to say we might
do that now. Let's want to do it right now?
Yeah, let's do it now, because I think it makes more sense. Because if you could just say a little bit more about Imagism, because the most famous, probably the most famous Imagist poem is Ezra Pound's At a Station of the Metro, right?
Yeah. So, here's In a Station of the Metro. It's a two-line poem, and the poetry is really what happens between the two lines, and it's never stated, right? It's a perfect example of parataxis. And there are spaces after like every three words in these lines because Pound wants to isolate them. So
before you go, I'd like you to explain what parataxis is for our listeners who aren't professors of literature.
Oh, good point. Well, it's let's just say it's the leaving out of overt connections. It's a poetry of juxtaposition. And this poem is a good example of it.
Go for it.
Well, you were right to call me out on that. So here's Pound's 1913 poem, In a Station of the Metro. The apparition of these faces in the crowd. Petals on a wet black bough. And Pound tells us that what happened was he was in the Paris metro, and he's there right as a train pulls into station. And, you know, the metro in that era would have been dark and smoky. You know, what light there was came from gas lamps. And so the doors of the train open, and these faces come pouring out, and some of them are illuminated by these gas lights for just a moment before they swoop by him. And it had a powerful effect on him. And he said he spent months trying to get it right. You know, first he writes a super long poem, you know, 80 lines. And then he keeps whittling it away, trying to capture the essence of that experience. And he ends up with the two lines I just quoted. So on the one hand, you have the very modern urban image, the apparition of these faces in the crowd, right? And the important word there is apparition.
Yeah.
It's not what these faces actually were. It's how they strike him. And then the second line is from nature, and it's also from Japan, from Japanese watercolors. Petals on a wet black bough, like a flowering tree. There's a rainstorm that blasts some of the flowers apart, and the petals stick to the branch. And what do you do with that? The poem isn't didactic. It doesn't tell you, right?
So to some degree, the sound of it pulls it together, right? Though, because like bow and crowd have a kind of slant rhyme to them that catches your ear if you read it out loud, or if you listen to Michael Coyle reading it out loud, reciting it out loud. And the alliteration at the end as well, really... black bow, and then the the way that the rhythmically it's wet black bow, that like the three monosyllabic words at the end of
right part the of succession of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the poem doing all it can to get us to pause over each of those single syllable words. It's a poem that wants to be read deliberately, slowly. And it doesn't tell you what to think about anything. And the force of the few adjectives in the poem, it's really more just like, what kind of Blaupound wants us to see? That tree branch is wet and black, and the petals are white. He wants that contrast. But so Sandburg's poem, Subway, it's written 3 years later. It's also short, but it's a really different kind of poem.
Yeah. Should I read it just for the contrast?
Yeah, but as you're reading it, notice too all the prepositions it depends on.
Yeah. So this is Subway. Down between the walls of shadow, where the iron laws insist, the hunger voices mock. The worn wayfaring men with the hunched and humble shoulders throw their laughter into toil. Yeah, there's a lot of prepositions in there.
Mm-hmm.
Down between of.
And then the preposition, yeah, with the hunched and throw their laughter into toil. So it's doing the relating for us. It's a good example of Sandburg's populism, isn't it? Like, we're celebrating the working man. Their faces are worn because they work so hard. Their shoulders are hunched. But you know, like, Pound would never do something like this with the hunched and humble shoulders. Because, okay, hunched is a physical description. You're giving it to us directly. But humble is a moral commentary on it.
Yeah.
That move is super important to populist writing, but has no place in modernist writing.
Yeah, so like, let's just unpick that a little bit. It's important to the populist writing because Sandburg wants you to get it. He wants to give you an image, and he wants you to understand that image in a particular way, right? Like, he doesn't want you to misunderstand that the kind of joy of life and the toil of life are intertwined, and you know, and that there's something noble about this backbreaking work, even in the face of the mockery that comes before it. And well, oh no, I'm not remotely, I'll probably come back to this. I'm not remotely criticizing the position.
I know.
But he wants to make sure you get that. He doesn't want there to be ambiguity about how to read these working men in the subway.
Yeah. So there's absolutely right. He wants there to be no ambiguity about the moral superiority of these working people.
Yeah.
But then the opening line of the poem, down between the walls of shadow. And if I lean on that line, I don't know what that means. The walls of shadow? How is that different from the shadowed walls, the walls that are dark because there's no light on them? Is he making a deeper metaphorical point? Is he just not in absolute control of his language?
I was going to say that.
I'm not sure.
Is it like he wants the line to be a certain, because it's not a prose poem. He wants the line to be a certain length and a certain rhythm, and so he has to sort of slightly contort language to do it, which isn't necessarily the sign of a poet in control of language. But that's one way of thinking about it anyway. Sorry, carry on.
Yeah, and you know, the beginning of that poem, it sounds almost like a Kipling line, except he breaks off the rhythm. So if you start down between the walls of shadow where the iron laws insist, and I think of Kipling, you know, on the road to Mandalay where the flying fishes play, that kind of thing, right? But then he breaks off from it immediately. Like you get that sort of taste. But then the third line breaks that up. The hunger voices mock. Okay. You want to call attention to the fact that these people are hungry? That's a good way to do it. The music kind of stops. But the hunger voices mock? Why hunger voices and not hungry? And why are you, if you're talking about hunger, what are we doing talking about voices as opposed to men and women? is he making a sort of meta point about populist poetry, like hungry to tell it like it really is? But I don't see the poem delivering that either. And I'm sorry, it sounds like I'm just beating up on him, but I'm fascinated by Sandburg's genuine and immense popular readership. And none of the poets I usually write about ever had that. Eliot had something like it later in his life, but I'm not sure that he was as beloved as he was respected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he filled the football stadium at University of Minnesota with 15,000 people who came out to hear him, they weren't reciting the lines in their heads along with him. Actually, he wasn't reading poetry. He was giving a lecture about criticism, the frontiers of criticism. But do you see what I mean about Sandburg's language? The hunger mm-hmm. voices mock. If you were teaching one of your writing students in a workshop, I suspect you would stop them right there.
And be like, what the hell does this
say
mean?
Do-over in some way or the other.
Yeah. On the other hand, I kind of like it. I talk about this with my writing students sometimes, where there's a difference between reading something in a workshop and reading something that's been published. And the way you approach reading in these different contexts is important. And I'm more forgiving of the hunger voices mock in a published collection of poems than I am in a workshop, maybe, where I might ask someone to push, to explain what they're driving at.
I mean, it could even mean voices mock the hunger, but I don't see how that fits either. You see what I mean? It's like words set free, but they don't reconnect in a way that takes me anywhere. But the poem right after that is called The Shovel Man. And that might be Sandburg at his populist best. Because I'm not trying to disrespect him. I'm just thinking about what is his legacy for us in the 21st century? So The Shovel Man, maybe I should just read it because it's quite short. On the street, slung on his shoulder, is a handle halfway across. Tied in a big knot on the scoop of cast iron are the overalls faded from sun and rain in the ditches. Spatter of dry clay sticking yellow on his left sleeve, and a flimsy shirt open at the throat. I know him for a shovel man. A dago working for a dollar, 6 bits a day, and a dark-eyed woman in the old country dreams of him for one of the world's ready men with a pair of fresh lips and a kiss better than all the wild grapes that ever grew in Tuscany. Okay. Now, that word dago, problematic.
Yeah.
But this shows up a lot in Sandburg. He's not, this is a poem that's loving this guy and celebrating, mm-hmm. What he brings to the American mosaic, right? There are lots of words like this that show up, and I don't want to have to defend them. I just want to say it's not a racist gesture. It might be a racialist, but there's no hatred here, right?
Yeah, so it's probably him trying to speak the language of the common man, right? Like, these are the terms that are thrown around on the street, and so he's going to use them as well. And that doesn't take away the problem.
That's exactly it.
But it offers an explanation for what is at play, I suppose.
Well, I think it's the perfect explanation, Doug. So this is Sandburg imitating the way he hears working men talk.
Mm-hmm.
So we could argue, or other people can argue, well, isn't it the poet's job to sort of, transform ordinary speech into something better? But what I'm really noticing here is he's saying, even this guy who's shoveling garbage in the street has something noble about him. And even he is inspiring the love of a woman, right? Him as well as, some aristocrat or capitalist, sitting in his fancy villa eating Italian grapes. That is the kind of moment, I think, that made Sandburg so beloved in the first half of the 20th century. But I think a 21st century reader may not get past that word that we were just talking about.
No, that's also true. But this comes back to something you said right at the beginning, that of your idea that, you know, the kind of high point of literature in America is 1880 to 1920, when there's no TV and no radio, and, you know, what do you have, and what, like, so like a thing that we still concern ourselves with today when it comes to art is how we see ourselves and our experience reflected in the art that we read and watch and examine and whatever, right? Like the kind of phrase, I feel seen, or that kind of thing, or representation of various individuals or groups in art. And so, like, we concern ourselves with how race or sexuality or these kinds of things are portrayed in television shows or in films or whatever. But, like, if, you know, you don't, if you can't afford in 1916, when this poem was published in this book, to go, you can't afford to go to the theater to watch a play. And you might read a newspaper, which might publish poems. You might pick up a poem somewhere else. You might have Rachel Lindsay hand you a poem in exchange for bread while he's walking his 600 miles down to Florida or whatever. And, you know, you're suddenly seeing yourself represented in this poem, and represented as worthy, as, like, you know, worthy of artistic representation and as in a dignified way. That's not necessarily, I don't have any access to this, you know, myself, sitting in London in 2021, but, like, that could be quite a powerful thing if you're, assuming you're literate, I suppose. I don't know what literacy, English literacy levels were like amongst the Italian garbage shovelers in Chicago in 1916, but there's something valuable about that representational aspect.
Yeah. Hey, well, there's one other thing I want to say about this poem, and the way to say it is to read the very next poem in the volume. And these are all super short. This one's only 7 lines long. And the title of it, as
it's just half a sonnet.
Not even. It's not even an octave.
Not even. Yeah.
Right? So the titles matter, right? So it matters that poem we've been talking about is called The Shovel Man. This one is called A Teamster's Farewell, with a subtitle, Sobs en route to a Penitentiary. And this one is actually probably a better poem than The Shovel Man. Goodbye now to the streets and the clash of wheels and locking hubs, the sun coming on the brass buckles and harness knobs, the muscles of the horses sliding under their heavy haunches. Goodbye now to the traffic policeman and his whistle, the smash of the iron hoof on the stones, all the crazy, wonderful, slamming roar of the street. Oh, God, there's noises I'm going to be hungry for. Here's Sandberg's whole program in a nutshell, right? It's the ordinary sounds of a working city. And I know you want to get to the title poem of this volume. This might be the way there. It's those ordinary sounds that he hears America's music, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. This is getting into it, like, exactly where I wanted to go, actually, because we've kind of been building slowly towards it. This has come again. I'm harping on about this a bit because I think it matters. Like, this is that populist drive is partly, it's not just about being populist for the sake of being populist or popular or whatever. It's like, you know, in that Whitman-esque way, it's like, it's about using poetry to try and constitute and embody the nation, like trying to, like, you know, I'm resisting, but I'm going to say it anyway. It's a very self-conscious attempt at being one of Shelley's unacknowledged legislators of the world. Like, I really think that, like, you know, like Whitman in his preface to the first edition of Leaves of Grass is just going on and on and on about the greatest poet must embody this and this and that, you know, the implication being that he's the greatest poet, but only like a man in his 20s could write something like that.
Listen to you, old timer.
yeah. When I was a lad. This is Sandberg trying to do that and give dignity to the working men and women of the nation as worthy of the highest ideals and worthy of poetry. One of the reasons that you said this is actually a better poem than The Shovel Man, and I have a half thought through theory about why. So Sandberg was a journalist for basically his whole life. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he wrote a book that was based on things he was writing before, during, and after the 1919 race riots in Chicago. And it's a book of journalism, essentially. And he was a reporter for various newspapers. And so part of that job, particularly in, I think, American traditions of journalism, is being an observer, being, you know, half in and half out of things that you're writing about. And a lot of these poems, there's like a whole, like I could go through a list of them in this collection, are the position the speaker of the poem as that kind of observer watching the person who is the subject of the poem. It's like The Shovel Man, I know him for a shovel man. Somebody's watching The Shovel Man, right? And there's like a fishmonger, a Jewish fishmonger in another poem who,
yeah,
again, it's like, I know, it's the first line is, I know a Jew fish crier down on Maxwell Street. It's that's a big Chicago image there. There's others where it's like, I was talking to this, I was watching this. And there's always this I, this self-conscious I, who's kind of like half in and half out. And the Teamster's Farewell is actually embodying the point of view of the Teamster going off to prison. And that's the difference in the poem.
Hey, so Doug, as you say this, I wonder if you're thinking of Baudelaire's insistence that the modern poet has to be a man of the modern city, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the crowd, but not of it. That's your halfway in, yeah, halfway out, yeah, right? And he's just there to sort of transform these momentary experiences, these glimpses of other lives, transform them into the permanent form of a poem. Yeah. Do you see Sandberg as having any relation to that, or does Sandberg get there in a different way?
I do. I'm trying not to laugh because there's a quotation I have of something Sandberg said. I think it's when he won the Pulitzer Prize or something. He said this, and before I read this, you have to take this. I feel like Sandberg is saying this tongue in cheek, or at least partly tongue in cheek. He says, "Here's the difference between Dante, Milton, and me. They wrote about hell." They wrote about hell, but never saw the place. I wrote about Chicago after looking the town over for years and years.
Oh, that's nice, actually. That's really nice.
And I think there's a lot, like, it's great because it's got the humor. It's got the kind of slightly, I mean, it sets a certain tone about one's attitude, and I think a kind of Chicago attitude as well. But he's also not entirely, he's not exactly equating Chicago with hell, but he's not equating Chicago with hell. And again, this, but he is insisting on this point of, I looked the town over for years and years. Is that kind of, that fits in with that Baudelaire of, you know, the in but apart kind of notion. I think it also sets us, again, like I said earlier, a certain tone for how Chicago literary endeavor in general over the mid part of the 20th century in particular starts to develop, and the attitude that writers like, you know, like Richard Wright and like James Farrell and like Nelson Algren have towards the city and themselves in relation to the city. I mean, that quotation is not too close or not too far off from something that you might hear Algren say. He'd say it further out the side of his mouth probably, but maybe this is where we look at the title poem, Chicago, which is not a prose poem. it's actually, you know, but I think it's also that, I think what it is, I think, is the poem that's kind of the most Whitman-esque, other than, I think it's got the kind of most kind of Leaves of Grassy type of Whitman-y vibe. I don't know, is that a word that we use in English literature studies?
Sure. And he takes a lot of structural principles from Whitman too, not least of which is that anaphoric structure, that is a succession of lines that begin with that conjunction, and this and that.
Well, and it's also then the it's also the link between Whitman and Ginsberg that we touched on earlier. But let's listen to this poem, because I think it also sets, again, it sets this kind of tone. I looked the place over for years and years, that I think just pervades an attitude about Chicago and the literature of Chicago in particular. So this is Chicago. It's got a famous, the opening is famous and is the riposte, I suppose, to Archibald MacLeish, that there's no one poem. I think this is the one poem. Hog butcher in for the fact, world. You cut me off just as I was being, go ahead.
I'm so sorry. I hope our producer can edit that out. But but this poem is often reprinted just in part. Yeah. In other words, you just see these five lines. They resonate differently in the context of the full poem. So
yeah.
You're right. Let's hear it.
Hog butcher for the world, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads and the nation's freight handler, stormy, husky, brawling, city of the big shoulders. They tell me you are wicked and I believe them, for I've seen your painted women under the gas lamps luring the farm boys. And they tell me you are crooked and I answer yes, it is true, I have seen the gunmen kill and go free to kill again. And they tell me you are brutal, and my reply is, on the faces of women and children, I have seen the marks of wanton hunger. And having answered so, I turn once more to those who sneer at this my city, and I give them back the sneer, and say to them, come and show me another city with lifted heads, singing so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning, flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job. Here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little soft cities. Fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness, bareheaded, shoveling, wrecking, planning, building, breaking, rebuilding, under the smoke, dust all over his mouth, laughing with white teeth, under the terrible burden of destiny, laughing as a young man laughs, laughing even as an ignorant fighter laughs who has never lost a battle, bragging and laughing that under his wrist is the pulse and under his ribs the heart of the people, laughing. Laughing, the stormy, husky, brawling laughter of youth, half naked, sweating, proud to be hog butcher, tool maker, stacker of wheat, player with railroads, and freight handler to the nation. It's quite a poem. I really love this poem.
Well, it really is the place where he announces himself, isn't it? It's also a good example of how Chicago earned its nickname, the Windy City. You know that story.
Yeah.
Chicago is not a particularly windy place. But at the time of the Columbian Exposition, 1893, there was so much press celebrating Chicago, puffing Chicago, that a New York columnist complained about Chicago as the windy city, because
they're blowing
the
hot air.
Was him making, they're blowing a lot of hot air, right? But Chicago was proud, and it had reason to be proud.
And, you know, he answers that, like, you can sneer at this, my city. I'll give you back the sneer and say, what do you do with all that laughter at the
I think what Sandburg is trying to suggest there is that there's a joy in this work.
Yeah.
You know, you compare the way that Sandburg and the other populists whom we've mentioned treat Chicago, contrast that with how people like Henry James or Edith Wharton were representing New York, right? New York was being celebrated in terms of its cultural elites. I don't know of any writers who do that with Chicago. And there were plenty of Robert Barons in Chicago, McCormick and the others, right?
Yeah.
So he's celebrating Chicago as a working city and finding joy in that. It's bareheaded, right? These aren't fancy people in bowler hats, right? It's shoveling, it's wrecking.
Yeah. It's also a dumb, naive boxer who's going to get knocked out at some point.
Yeah.
I really like that image. And I think, again, it's an image that you see reflected in later literature written about the city.
Yeah. But you know, there are also a couple moments in here that make this poem hard for 21st century readers. Chicago is fierce as a dog with tongue lapping for action, cunning as a savage pitted against the wilderness, like, oh, hello. This was a century ago, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And that's not it's not a racist comment. He's celebrating Chicago's ability to be like that savage. And that kind of primitivism was endemic in American literature. And not just white writers and black writers who think of Langston Hughes's The Negro Speaks of Rivers, the poem that made him famous, right? So it's not like we can't deal with this. It's not like, you know, we have to cancel the poem because that line's in there, but you can't help but notice it. But
yeah, and you have to think about it and recalibrate a little bit and talk about it without excusing it.
Yeah. Yeah. So you were asking about that laughter. I think it's just part of the, what he says, you know, the heart of the people, the joy. This is Chicago, but implicitly, this is also Sandburg's view of America.
Yeah. Well, you know, Chicago writers are always concerned with making Chicago, maybe not always concerned, but often concerned with making Chicago a thing that is a concerns
America.
Of Chicago are concerns of America. Sure. You know, I am an American, Chicago born, Chicago, that somber city. Saul Bellow, who is no populist, but that's, you know, that I hear echoes of this poem in those opening lines of The Adventures of Augie March.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
And so I think that's where, for me, and maybe this is a good place to wrap up our discussion, coming back to that Archibald MacLeish thing. I think, you know, I kind of facetiously am saying, like, I'll give you this poem as an argument against MacLeish, but I'm not sure the poem really is an argument against MacLeish, because I think, if anything, this one single poem that he's most known for, he's only known for, as you said, the first few lines, but they carry the they carry that general importance of Sandburg in the lines of this poem. I think that the populism is there, the sincerity of that populism, the energy that he has for it, and the kind of breadth of his interest in the working people and the working city. I think he sees this, like, it's interesting, this is the beginning of urban America, and this is a poet who sees the city as the people there doing the stuff, building the things, and his legacy is in that kind of celebration of an America that does.
Yeah, and we remember that Archibald MacLeish wasn't just a poet more celebrated in his day than ours, but he was also a librarian of Congress, and he was very interested in poems that represented America. So Sandburg was no modernist. He wasn't interested in aesthetics. He was a romantic, and he was very sentimental. You know, there's another Chicago poem a few pages after the opening poem. It's just four lines. They will say, "Of my city, the worst that men will ever say is this. You took little children away from the sun and the dew and the glimmers that played in the grass under the great sky and the reckless rain, and you put them between walls." There's this deep indignation, right? This deep romantic indignation, this opposition between the beauties of nature and this ugly working world that we've made. But, you know, the poem says, they will say, this is the worst that you can say of Chicago.
Yeah.
So it's very sentimental. He had a good heart, and he had a way of identifying moments that were worth holding on to. Like all these little short poems where people are identified by their occupation, and their occupation is never stockbroker, artiste, right? It's always the working people of the streets. A lot of poems about prostitutes, which is kind of embarrassing. Like, look at me, I can look at these working women and not be appalled. But, you know, he wasn't Arthur Simmons either. It's not like he was frequenting. He's just trying to show us that his vision of the street is inclusive and real.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks, Doug. This was kind of fun.
Thank you, Michael, for joining me and for expounding at such great length on modernism and Pound and Sandburg. I think it's interesting. I genuinely think it's interesting to remember that Carl Sandburg is doing this at a time of, you know, the Wasteland and Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot and this like high modernist literature that has had such an influence over English language literature for, you know, more than 100 years, and he's still part of the conversation of that time. I find that really fascinating, and it's why I think Sandburg, though his poems don't necessarily stand up to the kind of scrutiny that you can give to something like The Pound at a station of the metro, they're still kind of worth revisiting and enjoying and thinking about and spending some time with, because they are fun. I mean, that's all I want to say. They're fun.
Yeah.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks, Doug.
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, as well as the Chicago-Hamburg sister city relationship, why don't you visit us at our website, americazentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americazentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americazentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americazentrum.de. Thanks for listening.